Well, as one of the speakers that's from this congregation, let me add my personal welcome to all of you. We are glad that you are here in the auditorium. Our greetings also for those who are listening over the internet, and we're grateful for those who will view these lessons in years to come. For all of you, we're grateful for your interest in God's Word and in this great book of Daniel. The topic of this lectureship is indeed Daniel. This first lesson is an introduction to that book. It would be a challenge. There are many great books in the Bible, but it would be a challenge to suggest any book, New or Old Testament, that has a greater wealth and diversity of spiritual fundamentals than does the book of Daniel. It is a wonderful blending together. It's a wonderful tapestry, if you will, of the godly character of Daniel, myriad examples of God working out his will on earth, even involving some of the greatest nations that have ever existed, and some simply amazing examples of predictive prophecy. And yes, another commentary is needed on the book of Daniel. Those of you who are familiar with this lectureship know that the printed product that comes out of these lectures is indeed a verse-by-verse commentary on the book that we cover this year, the book of Daniel. Another book is needed for a couple of reasons. Smith observes that the vast majority of the voluminous literature on Daniel is largely worthless. Why does he think that it's worthless? He says that most interpreters attempt to superimpose the book on the book, modern schemes of prophetic interpretation. He says fanciful exegesis is supported by irrelevant cross-references based on a mere coincidence of terminology. We need more sound material on the book of Daniel. The other reason we need another book on Daniel is our society, it seems like steadily and purposefully, is heading off in a very different direction than biblical principles. What we need is, we need the corrective course that is set by the book of Daniel. The great truths that are in Daniel. The great truths about the one true God. And we see the power of a godly example. The balance of this introduction will talk about the background, the national, political, and spiritual background of the time. We, of course, will talk about the man Daniel, his life, his influence, his character. We'll talk about the book of Daniel, the usual things, the title, the authorship, the date, the canonicity, and that is, does it really belong among the Bible books? The arrangement and text of Daniel. There are some very unusual and very interesting features there. And in the literary features, we'll spend our time talking about that highly figurative language, that apocalyptic language. And then we'll close with three very practical lessons from the book of Daniel. The national and political background. As we begin to look at the times that surrounded this man Daniel, what we find is there's a great similarity, really, among the times of all of those who are known as major prophets. And that is, they were God's messengers during critical times. Isaiah was the subject of these lectures in 2009 and 2010. His writings were centered around that time period when the northern kingdom of Israel was captured by the Assyrians in 721. Isaiah passed from the scene. And so did the Assyrians. The fading Assyrian Empire gave way to the growing nation of Babylon, and it would be the Babylonian Empire that would, in fact, capture that southern kingdom of Judah. And this figure, and those of you who look in from the recordings in years to come, this is on page 4 of the book. It shows the key characters of the period. Let me zoom in on here. It shows the two kings that built the great nation of Babylon. There was Nabopolassar, followed by Nebuchadnezzar. The second row, just as a reminder, is the kings of the southern kingdom, starting with good King Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, who of course was the king when the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar conquered the southern kingdom, destroyed the city of Jerusalem. The third group that's down at the bottom, and it may be difficult to read here in the audience, but when you get your book, look on page 4. These are the prophets of the era. Jeremiah. Jeremiah had his work among those who remained behind in Jerusalem. Jeremiah and Lamentations were the subject of these lectures in 2007, 2008. And then there was Ezekiel. Ezekiel was taken to Babylon in the second wave of captives in 597. His work was among the common people, probably in the suburbs of Babylon. Ezekiel was the subject of our lectures last year in 2012. This year it's Daniel. Daniel was one of the brightest and the best among those who were in Jerusalem, so he was one of the first taken into Babylonian captivity in 606. His work, very unusual, his work was among the ruling class in the city of Babylon. And of course, he's the subject of the lectures this year. What was the spiritual condition of the Israelites during this period? Perhaps the best description comes not from Daniel, but from one of the other prophets of the era, Ezekiel. Really, in God's own words, we have this very short, very unflattering description of the Israelites. God told Ezekiel, "But the house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted." Ezekiel 3:7. Not words you would want to hear on the day of judgment. The life of Daniel, we really do not know very much about Daniel's family. He was apparently of noble, maybe even royal parentage. From the terms that are used in the text to describe him, many would conclude that he was a young man, maybe 14, 15 years old, when deported in 606, which means his birth would have been about the year 620. There is no mention of a wife or children. Most of what we know about the experiences of Daniel's early life really come from our knowledge of the qualities of the young men that were selected to be taken away first to Babylon. The selection criteria are given in the first few verses of Daniel. The ones selected should be those in whom was no blemish, but well-favored, and skillful in wisdom, cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, Daniel 1:4. And we do know at least a little bit about the environment that he was in once he was taken away in Babylonian captivity. We can infer that he was a part of the royal environment there, at least was very close to it. The text tells us that he refused the opportunity he had to partake of the king's food. That means he must have had access to it. He must have been in that area, Daniel chapter 1. It also talks about appearances that he made before the kings, Daniel chapter 2 and 5 and 6. And really, I think we're given a great look into his work ethic because of his record of commendatory service under three of the greatest kingdoms that have ever existed, the rulers Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar and Darius. There's no mention of his death. The date of the final vision that he had is given as the third year of Cyrus. This would have been about 536 B.C. So, given that by that time he would have been in his mid-80s, it would have been rare in those days for somebody to live past 90. So we can probably date the writing of the book somewhere around 530 or 536. Daniel's lifetime then would have been a span of 80, 85, maybe as much as 90 years. And I would suggest to you his lifetime was a very interesting period. In one of the classes that we've been having here in Shirts, the question was asked, who would you like to have lunch with among the Bible characters? Of course, there are many. Would you like to have lunch with Jesus, the Apostle Peter, the Apostle Paul? Let me tell you, it would be very interesting to have a lunchtime conversation with the man Daniel. His birth would have been only a couple of years after the reforms of Josiah, so the environment of his early life would have been affected by those great and those very positive changes. In his youth, he would have witnessed from Judea the progressive conquest of his homeland. And because he was a part of the first wave of deportees to Babylon, he would have already been in Babylon and aware of generically, maybe specifically, of the time that the ruling class from Jerusalem was taken there and those 10,000 captives. And think about this. It would have been from Babylon that he would have heard of Jerusalem's ultimate demise in 586. And maybe more remarkable than that, he would have been among or close to the ruling clan in Babylon when Babylon was conquered by the Persians, 539. And then he would have lived to hear the good news about the decree of Cyrus, which allowed the Jews to return to their homeland. I would suggest to you that few can match, from a very unusual viewpoint, a view of some of the greatest events, not only in the history of Israel, events in the history of the world. Daniel's mission. Daniel is called a prophet by our Lord himself in Matthew 24. But his role was not really like the other prophets. Daniel was largely isolated from his brethren, so he didn't serve in the usual capacity of a prophet, that is, one who is out among the people, admonishing them, rebuking them for their waywardness from the Lord. But though he really wasn't that typical kind of prophet, we can see where he had his great influence. We can see the influence that he had in the courts of kings. And what? What but the providence of God could have placed a godly man like Daniel with such an influence over those who were the captors of God's people? Surely, the place where he was put was a part of his mission from God. We see the influence that he had on the character of his fellow man. There's a reference to Daniel in Ezekiel 28. It seems, if it's the same Daniel, that his influence was beyond his immediate co-workers there, but even broadened into those who were further out in the other parts of the city. Then there's the influence of his writings. You know, it's not unusual for a substantial part of the influence of a prophet to be the things that are written in his book. But in most cases, the words that are written down about the prophet, the message of the prophet, are things that he said to the people. But again, Daniel is unusual. That's not really the case with Daniel. The message part of the book of Daniel is not really things that were spoken by Daniel. They were things that were spoken to Daniel by God. Chapter 7 through 12 records the vision and images that God revealed to Daniel. And through these messages to Daniel, God gave encouragement to his people by revealing to them, albeit in signs and symbols, he revealed to his people his long-term plan for them. Daniel's great character, as a way of summarizing his character, let's just note that Daniel was also faithful during favorable times. From his youth, we would conclude that he was in very favorable circumstances, perhaps among the elite. We know from the book of Daniel that he served in high official positions. Don't our observations of people today, don't they tell us that those who exist in an environment of plenty, maybe that's a greater challenge to their character than living in an example of poverty. The character development of Daniel was not marred by the favorable circumstances of his youth, the favorable positions that he had later in his life. We might note that Daniel was faithful in transition. What would be the effect on Daniel when he left his life among his people? His life among the elite of his people was transferred to another kingdom hundreds of miles away where he was to be placed in service. In the case of Daniel, his character shone all the brighter in that great transition. And maybe the lesson that we need most of all today, let's note that Daniel was faithful when he was treated unfairly. He was the target of the plot of some of his jealous peers, but he did not respond with revenge. And how much do we need the example of Daniel's character in this area? Matthew 5:44, Jesus teaches us how we should respond when people despitefully use us. But we don't always respond that way, do we? How much we need the example of Daniel. So as we study Daniel this week, remember the admonition in Hebrews 6 to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promise. Daniel is certainly one of those. And now the book of Daniel. The title that's given to Daniel is the name of its earthly writer and its main earthly subject. The word Daniel means God is judge or God is my judge. And maybe we could conclude from the character of Daniel that Daniel understood that message and he took it to heart. Authorship, the book claims to be written by Daniel. And the recording of the visions in chapter 7 through 12, the expressions I, Daniel, me, Daniel, occur many times. He is without doubt the main character in the narratives that are in the first part of the book. His names, either Daniel or Belteshazzar, as he was known there, occur over 60 times. In fact, Christ himself refers to the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, Matthew 24:15. And since the book of Daniel twice refers to abomination that made desolate, chapter 11, chapter 12, the reference to Daniel's book seems to be unmistakable, thereby confirming the identity of the author. The author is confirmed by Jesus himself. For the date of writing, we can determine that really by combining the accounts that we read about in the book of Daniel with things that we know from historical data. What we understand is Daniel, as the book presents him, he is an eyewitness to the things that are recorded in his book. The events in the book described with the assaults against Jerusalem about 605-606 continues through those three kings, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and Darius. And the story really continues up until things, as I mentioned earlier, that occurred in the third year of Cyrus, which was about 536. So the book must have been completed no earlier than that date. And again, if we assume that Daniel maybe had a lifetime of a maximum around 90, the book would have been written shortly after 536. Now, of course, those who are consistently, those who seem to think that it's their mission in life to be critical of the Bible, have proposed different dates and different authors. And largely, as in the case, many cases, it's by those who just refused to believe in predictive prophecy. Well, the book of Daniel contains some remarkable examples of predictive prophecies. He predicts things in great detail in the book that did not occur until after 200 B.C. So, to the surprise of no conservative scholar, many say, well, the book must have been written after that time, so that, in fact, the record of those events is a historical record, not predictive prophecy. And I would just point out that this challenges not only the prophetic elements of the book, it challenges the date of the book. It challenges the author of the book, which, by the way, remember, was attested to by Jesus himself. I will leave you to read in the book manuscript some of the various liberal attacks, most of which have been skillfully answered, and you can see how they have been answered. Let's talk a moment about canonicity. That is, canonicity means, should Daniel be accepted as one of the inspired books? The short answer to that, of course, is yes, it should be, and has been included in the list, in most lists of those accepted books of the Bible. Really, those who want to quibble with his acceptance as an inspired book have centered their arguments on the same thing we mentioned earlier. And that is, they don't believe in predictive prophecy. So they want to say, well, Daniel couldn't have written the book in his time frame. Must have been written by somebody else much later in history. What's perhaps interesting about Daniel is not whether or not he should be in the list of Bible books, but the different places that he's been listed. We have him listed among the prophets, among the major prophets. We're accustomed to that listing. But some, in some lists, have put Daniel in the writings, along with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Now, maybe, just maybe, because this is because in Daniel's book, he's never referred to as a prophet. Now, Jesus referred to him as a prophet, but in the book, he is not referred to by the typical Hebrew word for prophet. He is referred to by a word that means a seer or a wise man, kind of like Solomon. So maybe that's the reason some have grouped him in with the writings, not necessarily with the prophets. But if you go back in history to some of the earliest lists, as well as the list that we're familiar with today, he is listed among the prophets. Indeed, I'm one of the major prophets. The arrangement of the book and the text of the book is perhaps a little bit more interesting than the typical Old Testament book of the Bible. Daniel is not written as a progressive chronology. You don't start at the book and have a continuous chronological narrative all the way to the end. What I've tried to do in one of the lists that's in the book, in the manuscript there, is to take the different elements of Daniel and try to place them in a chronological order. But they weren't written in that order. But the book can roughly be divided like this chart, which I took from Smith. The first division, chapter 1 through 6, is six historical narratives about the experience of Daniel and his companions. The second part of the book, chapter 7 through 12, records the dreams, the visions which Daniel received. This is the part that's in that highly figurative language. One of the most interesting, one most unusual, it's not unique to Daniel, but there are only two or three books of the Bible that actually have include passages that are in some other language besides Hebrew. Daniel is one of those. The book of Daniel in chapter 1 may be spilling over a little bit into chapter 2, and the last four chapters is in Hebrew, but the core of the book is in Aramaic. This would have been a language, the language of the time. Daniel would have been familiar with this language because of his business dealings in the Babylonian Empire. What does this mean? It means that that central section that really pertained to the Gentile nations was written in a language that they would be able to read for themselves and understand. So it seems in the book of Daniel, the use of that second language had as its purpose making available to the people God's message to them in a language they could understand. But of course, when most people think of Daniel, what they think of is the highly figurative language, the apocalyptic language. The word apocalyptic is from a Greek word that means to uncover, hence to disclose or reveal. Daniel is one of three books that's known for its use. The other two are Ezekiel and Revelation. And it is likely not a coincidence that for all three of these books, the authors were out of their homeland when they wrote the books. What these three had in common was that there was a message of vital information that they wanted conveyed to their intended audience. But they needed to do that in a way that was not understood by the people who were holding them captive at the time, because that could have been very harmful to them. So the apocalyptic language then served as a kind of a code language to allow certain readers to understand the message. That would not have been because of the symbolism available to everyone. The problem in understanding the book, then, is breaking the code. And breaking the code is difficult because the images in apocalyptic literature like Daniel is not like the usual images that prophets use. The images in apocalyptic literature are more abstract. Gordon gives an example. It's from the book of Ezekiel, but I thought it helped understand the differentiation between usual prophetic images and those that are contained in apocalyptic literature. Gordon says in an allegory or a metaphor, that is the kind of comparisons you typically find in prophetic books. He says something real, like an unfaithful wife, is compared to something else that is real, like Jerusalem. In apocalyptic literature, something that is surreal, like a living creature, is compared to something that's real, like the judgment of God. In most ordinary prophecies, the message is delivered in words. In apocalyptic literature, the words describe a picture, and the message has to be discerned by interpreting the picture. Hence the special challenge to understand, decode the meaning of the picture, because therein is the meaning of the message. Time frame for apocalyptic literature is also very different than typical prophetic writings. The ordinary prophet may deal with the present and then the past and then the future, but in the text explains the time transition from one time period to another. Not so with apocalyptic literature. The apocalyptic writer combines the past, the present, and future all in one scene with one great sweeping description. The time jumps are not explained. Discerning the time frame is part of interpreting the image. So apocalyptic sections, therefore, are noted for their highly elaborate figures, symbols, and imagery. Now, three lessons from the book of Daniel. You know, there are many great lessons contained in the book. I've tried to choose three that I think are special with respect to the book of Daniel, and three that are very important for us today. One is God is in complete control. Of course, this is a common theme in the scriptures, but where can you find in any one book a more thorough demonstration of the depth and the breadth of control that God has over his creation. God's hand is seen in the actions of the greatest nations that have ever lived upon the face of the earth. And perhaps even more impressive is the way that God reveals in the later chapters of Daniel, God reveals in minute detail how he will use those nations in the future. On the other end of the spectrum is his control over the elements of nature. Those who are faithful to him are spared from a furnace that's heated to 7 times its usual temperature. He shuts the mouth of lions, Daniel 6, to preserve his servant Daniel. What does Daniel say? Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 through 22. Of God, Daniel says that God changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, knowledge to them that know understanding. He reveals the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth in him. Second message I think we can take away from the book of Daniel is we need to serve God with a faith like Daniel's. We can see the nature of his faith. We can see the impact that his faith had on him. We can see the impact that his faith had on his associates, even rulers, even kingdoms. Because of the consistency between his faith and his actions, his acknowledgement of his God, that is the one true God, his acknowledgement of God became contagious to the people around him, even the pagans around him. Well, there are a lot of parts of our world today that are pagan. We need to understand that we have the capability to influence them to acknowledge our God as the one true God. We need to remember that in all circumstances, our faithfulness must be such that it brings glory to God. The Apostle Peter wrote, 1 Peter 4:14, "If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are you. For the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified." We have the ability to glorify God. Third lesson, we need to make ourselves available for God's use. Sometimes are we so busy looking for other opportunities that we fail to recognize the opportunities that are right around us? You know, it seems unlikely to me that just a few months earlier, Daniel thought that he was going to be in the palace of a conquering nation, but that's where he found himself. And you know, his attitude could have been, the attitude of some would probably have been, well, this is just not a good place to be serving God. I need to wait for a better time. I need to wait for a better opportunity. How many people are there today that neglect the opportunities around them because they're looking for some better time or some better place? Somebody once said, you know, God has a lot of resources at his disposal. He is not so much interested in our ability as he is our availability. Are we making ourselves available to take advantage of the opportunities we have today? How can we conscientiously plead with God for other opportunities when we fail to capitalize on the ones that are right around us? Apostle Paul said, Colossians 4:5, "Walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time." That word time is a word that many people will translate as opportunities. We need to be redeeming. We need to be cashing in on the opportunities. Daniel took advantage of an extraordinary opportunity. Maybe our unusual circumstances, maybe that's our extraordinary opportunity. As a brief summary of Daniel's faith and character, Butler provides the following. Daniel was truly a man of God. He was ready at all times to declare without fear or favor what he believed and to stand for his convictions regardless of the circumstances or the consequences. His personal integrity was so great that he could be heard and trusted even by those monarchs who did not believe in his God. We need to have the same kind of influence today. But for us to have the same kind of influence, we've got to have the same kind of faith, and we have got to build the same kind of reputation. The Apostle Peter admonishes us in chapter 2, 1 Peter 2, 11 and 12. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may be by your good works which they behold, they may glorify God in the day of visitation. What great opportunities we have today in this nation at this time. And maybe we can learn better how to take advantage of those opportunities from the great prophet Daniel. Will you please join us, whether it's over the internet or in the auditorium, join us every day to learn about this great book, a part of God's Word. Thank you very much.